Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Deadhead Cannabis Show. My name is Larry Mishkin of the Hoban Law Group, and I'm one of your hosts for today's show. My co-host, Jim Marty of the Bridge West Accounting Group, is running a few minutes late, but in order to make sure we have maximum amount of time with our guests today, we're going to get the show started now, and Jim will join us when he does. Before we dive in, as Jim and I are normally prone to do, 30 seconds of updates on what we know and what we don't know. What we don't know is when they're going to make announcements in Illinois and tell us who the winners of the licenses are. What we do know is that they haven't done it yet. And despite our best efforts to try to get some specific information from any of the relevant agencies, all we get are soon, soon, soon. And it's unfortunate, as we've been saying, not only because people want to know, but because people are being financially affected by this, especially folks who are paying for contingencies to keep real estate held for them until they find out if they have a license, or people who are making deals to get cultivation equipment shipped over, anticipating that they would either find out or not by a certain date so that they could cancel the order if necessary. And these are just some of the problems that people here are facing. I suppose, on the other hand, the good news is it does give people more time to kind of plot out their business strategies and think about things that they want to do. And in that regard, and I think a good tie into today's guest, is that many of my cultivation clients right now are taking advantage of this time. And one of the things that they're trying to do is make determinations as to what strains they want to grow if they get a license. And it's not so easy in this industry to just say, well, heck, I want to grow Blue Dream. If you want to grow Blue Dream, you either have to have Blue Dream seeds, you have to have Blue Dream clones. And more important than that, you have to be able to verify that it's, in fact, it's Blue Dream. Or if someone comes and has some interesting marijuana that they would like you to sell, and they tell you that this is great stuff and it has a certain THC level and a certain CBD level and a certain terpene profile, and it all sounds great that you can tell your customers, but how can you be sure and how can you really, really back that up? And many, many other possibilities out there, which brings me to our guests today, Josh Werzer and Alec Dixon of SC Labs. And both Josh and Alan work at this company. They both have experience and training in cannabis and in quality and safety standards and cannabis science and terpenes. And from our perspective today, very importantly, testing and all the things that are necessary in that regard. So first of all, Josh and Alec, welcome very much to today's show, and so glad you guys could be on.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
No, we're glad to have you guys. And as we were talking about the three of us just prior to going starting our taping today, this is becoming a very, very timely topic as people are really, really interested in genetics all of a sudden. For instance, here in Illinois, we have the medical people who have been doing it for a long time, the Crescos, the GTIs, and they have huge 100,000 square foot facilities. And as a result, under the new adult use laws, they got matching 100,000 square foot cultivation facilities for all of their adult use planting. The 75 licenses that are about to be awarded, or excuse me, the 40 craft grow licenses that are about to be awarded are craft grow, which by definition under Illinois law means you can only grow on 5,000 square feet. So the standard thinking here is that you can't compete with the big boys growing the standard strains. It's all going to be about genetics and really making your mark on the market by bringing to market those types of specialty strains. But as any of us who have ever dealt with a guy in the back row of a Grateful Dead concert who has a backpack full of stuff knows, we never really know for sure exactly what we're getting. And that's where you guys come into play. Can you tell us, please, first of all, you know, a quick little bit of background on both of you and what brought you into this business and exactly what it is that SC Labs does, what it's, you know, designed to do, and kind of what your goals are with it going forward.
Okay. Well, so I guess I'll go first. This is Josh again, but I'm a chemist by training, and I was, my background is, I did some pharmaceutical research and development out of college. Then I went on to work for Samsung doing electronic materials research and development. So developing sort of the materials that computer chips and displays and things like that are made out of. Sort of took an interview and then ended up taking a position kind of on a lark at the very first laboratory that would do cannabis testing in the States or anywhere, I guess, for that matter, for medical marijuana patients. And this is, you know, 11 years ago, and it was a lab in the East Bay area. And they just opened their doors. They needed a laboratory director. And I went in for an interview. I was kind of unhappy with my job, took the interview, and they offered me the position, and sort of looked at it as something I would do as a bridge job, leave it off my resume and go get a real job as soon as I found something. And, you know, 11 years later, it's still what I'm doing. So left that place, obviously, shortly, about a year into that position, after Alec and I were friends. And and, you know, kind of through that, you know, through working at that position, and he was working in the industry, and I'll let him kind of explain that. You know, we'd done a lot of, you know, talking big about how, you know, we should do something similar, but do it differently and do it better, and sort of more focus on bringing kind of all of the analytical capabilities that are available in other industries to the cannabis industry, and sort of bring that same type of rigor to the cannabis industry, and concentrate and focus on kind of more of the safety assays as well as terpenes and things like that. And so we did that. We left. I left that lab, and Alec left his position, and we had two other partners to start with. So there's four of us, and we started SC Labs in 2010, and have been doing that ever since. So. You know, in we're in California. We're located in Santa Cruz. Now we also have a lab just outside of Oregon in Tigard, and you know, and so we've sort of, you know, I think over the last 10 years been able to see the cannabis industry really mature from a really cool vantage point. Sort of everyone comes through the lab one way or another, and even before kind of mandatory testing, all of the big players and the real kind of innovators and people pushing the boundaries in cannabis. We're probably doing a lot of testing, and you know, our lab was, I like to think, one of the sort of larger or kind of more fully outfitted labs out there from the beginning. So you know, it's been really cool just kind of to have the vantage point we've had, get to interact and sort of help kind of develop some of these products in one way or another, and sort of interact with kind of the biggest movers and shakers in the industry over the last 10 years.
Oh, that's very, very exciting stuff. Alec, how about a little bit of background on yourself?
Yeah, so I'm originally from Roswell, New Mexico, and when I turned 18, I joined the Navy, and I was in submarine duty, 5 years in the Navy, and I ended up getting out of the Navy. That was from 2001 to 2006. I was actually in boot camp right before, you know, August 16th of 2001. So right. You know, less than a month before September 11th. But yeah, wow. Spent 5 years in the service on submarine duty, and got out of the Navy in Virginia Beach, and met my now ex-girlfriend, but one of the most influential females I've ever met in my life. We started dating. I got out of the Navy, saved up money, moved to California, and then moved up to moved to Santa Cruz, where she was originally from. And when we're having a hard time finding jobs and a place to live, we moved up to Laytonville, about 5 miles north of the hog farm, Bob Barsotti's spot, up in Northern California, had an amazing space called Area 101. And a gentleman named Tim Blake became, you know, my born again weed father, one of the most influential people in my life, and you know, kind of introduced me to cannabis and organic. What organic even means, you know, just consuming foods and putting, you know, products on your body, and, you know, kind of, and how to grow cannabis. And so, you know, ended up moving to Santa Cruz, and, you know, my ex-girlfriend and Josh's partner, started working together when we were in Santa Cruz, at a cosmetic, store. And I was working in the hydroponic industry, selling soil and pesticide solutions to people as they were coming in to grow cannabis. And I was just from a very early on standpoint, just was started seeing a lot of the wrong ways people were doing it. You know, how you know, there was a split of people so dedicated to doing this pure, perfect, organic, as to the true purpose of this plant as they could. And then I saw this other group that, you know, would have, you know, kind of make mistakes, have massive issues, you know, and douse, you know, the gnarliest of Dow, DuPont, Syngenta poisons on the plant, really deep and latent to flower. And so that was just really kind of, that just stood out to me early on. And I got the, you know, blessed, amazing opportunity to meet Josh through our partners, and we started to become friends. We were both kind of, you know, had, you know, small indoors going in our garages, and, you know, just was really fascinated with the work he was doing as a scientist testing cannabis. And so, yeah, synchronicities of life came together. We came together, and now, you know, we're 11 years deep into cannabis testing. And one of the, you know, one thing I would love to leave my thought on is, you know, because I'm more from cultural anthropology and as my background, and ethnobotany, appreciation of plants and medicine used over time, and so much of my life and my philosophy now has been so deeply influenced by my work with SC Labs, you know, as a co-founder, and how much, you know, becoming a data, you know, trend scientist, you know, data, you know, analyzing data and understanding trends, how much I've come to learn from this plant's, you know, astounding. But, you know, come really understand that, you know, the work we're doing in testing cannabis is really helping to, you know, serve almost as a language of meaning to help understand this plant and how to use this plant most effectively and appropriately for each of the desired effects or results, or to treat various ailments that whatever it might be you're looking for to treat. But it's also simultaneously helping to clean up the earth, you know, the endocannabinoid, sure. The endocannabinoid system is, you know, the great balance system, the great homeostatic regulating system in our body that balances systems when they're all out of balance. And so I think it's doing that internally, but I also think it's doing it externally where we plant it, and how it's starting to balance and clean up and detoxify the soil, you know, as this great phyto remediator, you know, that we're now testing to a level nothing's ever been tested. So it's really cool. And I feel like the role we're doing, the role we serve is really helping to empower, you know, and really substantiate organic, and kind of really to bring to the awareness what else we're putting into our bodies, and, you know, what types of poisons are on them, and cannabis, and like just the how cannabis is now being tested. You know, it's cleaner than food, cleaner than water in a lot of, you know, cities and areas. And so it's, you know, and we're doing it, and it's working, and, you know, and you know, we could hold other, you know, consumer industries to similar accounts.
Well, it's really incredible to me. You know, and this is one of the other reasons why I like partnering with Jim Lardy, is that as a guy who came of age in the late 70s and early 80s, you know, the biggest decision that ever faced us, assuming we were even in a position where we got to make a decision, was Colombian, Thai stick, this, that, whatever they were calling it at the time. No strains, no indica, no sativa, no terpene profiles, no nothing. It was just marijuana. And we loved it. We had a great time. And, you know, it's kind of funny that now it's gotten to this point where, you know, it's on the one hand, it's absolutely fascinating and amazing to see all the different ways and all the different things that can happen to this plant, and all the uses that you can make of it. But I have to say, it just cracks me up a little bit, from going to, you know, just the drug of choice to hang out and, you know, listen to the Grateful Dead to now really becoming something that's, I mean, in some circles, people are saying that it could very well lead to the key to stop the coronavirus.
Yeah. And you know, I think in some ways you maybe had in some ways more diversity back then when you weren't taking this seriously. I think over the years, you know, as you know, cannabis breeding has become more specific. And I think, you know, maybe one of the disservices the laboratory testing industry has done to the cannabis industry, or the plant itself, is that, you know, with testing and more visibility into the, you know, kind of chemical constituents in cannabis, breeders have kind of responded, I guess, to market demands. And, you know, once we started putting a number to cannabis, well, then, you know, bigger is always better. And people started kind of racing to produce the strongest or the highest THC plants they could produce. And I think we saw, you know, what diversity was left after the drug war in kind of the cannabis genome, you know, a lot of it disappeared. You know, a lot of the strains just from, you know, 5-10 years ago when we started doing this, you know, that were, you know, really popular, desirable strains. Like I'm thinking Bubba Kush, LA Confidential, Granddaddy Perp, most of the purples that you know were really interesting, had really great flavors and kind of produced these unique kind of interesting highs. A lot of those have gone away because they don't test 30% THC or they don't test 25% THC. So, you know, I think things have gotten more sophisticated as a scientist and someone who kind of really appreciates the uniqueness of this plant to produce so many bioactive and potentially, medically beneficial compounds. I celebrate kind of the sophistication that we're getting out of cannabis, but you know, in some ways I do think we've lost something along the way. I think that's why Alec and I are pushing so hard to really highlight the terpene content of plants and to push for producers of cannabis to really look at the terpenes as their quantitative quality indicators rather than just kind of all absolute THC percentage. I don't judge my wine's quality based on the alcohol content, at least not since I was 18. And now that I think a sophisticated cannabis connoisseur is should be more interested in the flavors and sort of the unique kind of highs that one chemotype, which is kind of the term we use rather than strains, which is the sort of the chemical composition of a cultivar or a variety, is to look at look at the different terpene profiles cannabis can produce and sort of celebrate that and stop sort of purchasing our cannabis just based on what has the highest THC score, because that's really sort of driving a reduction in variety on our shelves and in the plant.
Well, I think you're right, and I think you're absolutely right. And all one has to do, I think, to see is look at what happened in the alcohol industry. For a long time there was just bourbon. Now there's so many different types of bourbon. It's all over the place. The consumer is demanding. We want this, we want that, and to your point about strength, yes, in the marijuana world, it does seem that everyone's always looking for that one that just gets you a little bit higher. But, I learned my lesson with bourbon 10 years ago and found out that you don't have to drink 110 proof bourbon. 80 proof bourbon works just fine, and you stay awake longer. So for me, that was great. And then, switching over to marijuana, once it got to the point where I actually had enough, in my own mind, confidence that there was more to all of this talk than just my kid coming home with the names of five crazy strains that I had never heard of in my life, it does make a big difference. And let me ask you this, because I think that one of the big secrets in the cannabis industry is that everybody talks about terpenes. And if you have a knowledge, let's say what my knowledge level is at, which is, very basic still, I know a terpene to be a cannabinoid, meaning one of the elements that's found in cannabis. I also know that it has basically generally something to do with taste, and that we actually have terpenes in any number of types of produce or things that are grown. It's not just unique to marijuana. But other than that, I don't really know that much more, other than sophisticated people who, at least people who I consider sophisticated in the marijuana world, will have that conversation. Well, did you try this strain? The terpene levels are this and that and the other. And it just doesn't mean that much to me. Can you help give us just a little bit of background and context as to what's really going on when we talk about a terpene profile?
Yeah, totally. Terpenes produced by plants, they're natural plant defense mechanisms produced that either lure in pollinators, repel predators. Terpenes produced by trees actually have an effect on calling in the rain. Which is something I just actually recently learned. But terpenes are kind of like the love language of nature, in a way, and the way that they kind of call in or cast out. And so terpenes kind of, the way they interact with our olfactory system and our olfactory nerve certain smells call us more than others. And we're all so very different, for so many very different reasons. And so it's really important, I think, to understand, because everybody's talking terps and talking terpenes without really understanding what it is we're talking about. And it's pretty basic too, because with cannabis, we've embarked over the last, since about 2013, we launched terpene testing, and since from then till now, we've done over, about 120,000 terpene tests plus, since. So diving into our terpene data was our first real effort into looking into and aggregating data. and you know, kind of, and so we started working with a data scientist and bioinformaticist and to help us to cluster the data by the primary and secondary tertiary terpenes to see how things sorted into similar groups, right? Like, and so, and you can think of it kind of like, you know, like back to the wine kind of analogy, you know, with white wines and red wines, and, you know, within red wines, there's Merlot and Cabernet and Pinot Noir and, you know, Sangiovese, and, you know, it keeps going, right? And so, you know, we're starting to be able to see this clarity with terpenes and cannabis in a similar way. And so, and so, you know, we test for over 30 plus terpenes, right? But really what we see is there's about 5 to 9 terpenes that define everything we've ever tested, that, or that the 90 plus percent of the majority of the content, the terpene content within the plant, is, you know, we see within, you know, these 5 to 9 terpenes. And so really to understand cannabis, and to understand the way cannabis classifies and sorts by primary terpenes is to understand 5 to 6 terpenes. And so it's this, like, and that's a lot easier, you know, for the average consumer to understand and to pick up on, you know, and sure. so really we're in, and most all of them are monoterpenes. There's monoterpenes, sesquiterpenes, and, you know, basically, you know, there's more isoprene units. Monoterpenes have, you know, least, and I wouldn't even try to get into this. This is Joshville's house, but essentially more isoprene units means higher boiling point. So low, you know, lowest isoprene unit terpene is the monoterpene, and most of the primary terpenes in cannabis are monoterpenes. So myrcene, terpenylene, limonene, pinene, those terpenes are mono. And then there's sesquiterpenes, and they have higher boiling points. But the reason why I bring up this mono versus sesqua is, you know, at room temperature, you start losing monoterpenes. You know, if you ever go into a field of cannabis in the middle of the day that's, you know, ripe and ready to harvest, and you smell the strains in the air, it's because the terpenes are boiling off off the plant, volatilizing and going into your nose, and your olfactory system's picking them up. So if you harvest in the middle of the day versus the middle of the night, you know, you get a very different overall terpene content that you're able to preserve in the harvest of the plant. That, you know, and that's getting into, again, this qualitative side of terpene content, because they're the most precious attributes that once they go away, it's swag. It smells like hay. It's like, even if it's 30% THC, cool. You know, it doesn't have that same, you know, je ne sais quoi in that way. But really, right. You know, kind of, but, you know, and really when we're talking about the terpenes that define cannabis, though, it's myrcene, which is hops and mango. That's like the fruit smells. So like, the blueberries and the cherry AKs and the tangies and forbidden fruits and the, you know, purples and a lot of the tropical fruit smells like mangoes and papayas and dream queens, all that stuff. That's myrcene. And that's the most predominant terpene. You know, then there's limonene, you know, limonene's more, so myrcene's more on the sedative side. Beta carotene is the peppery, earthy terpene. It's what's in a lot of the Girl Scout cookies and sherbets, gelatos, all that. That's on the relaxation side of it. So those two terpenes are more related to relaxation and sedation, whereas limonene, which is citrus, you know, pinene, which is pine, and terpenylene, which is like lilac, patchouli. Those three terpenes are more on the uplifting, cerebral, inspiring, kind of creative side of the spectrum. And so knowing those terpenes, you know, you can essentially categorize all strains. Sorry, go ahead, Josh.
Well, I just kind of wanted, I guess, try my best at describing kind of the chemistry that's going on there, because you know, cannabis, I think, is really a unique plant, because it is sort of like this terpene factory, and these terpenes are like Alex said, they're found in most plants in nature. They're when you think of the essential oil of a plant, you're actually thinking of the mixture of terpenes that gives that plant its unique aroma. And these, like Alex said, since many of them are very small, they're easily volatilized or they go into the air and you smell them. But the cannabinoids themselves are actually just specialized terpenes that only cannabis produces, or you know, now we're finding some other plants that produce cannabinoid like compounds, but they're just very specialized terpenes. And the terpenes begin with small chemicals that are sort of like, they're called isoprene units, like Alex said. They're sort of like the small Lego blocks, and you can make very complex molecules from these isoprene units or these sort of building blocks to the terpenes. And so The cannabis plant produces limonene, just like lemons. It produces myrcene, just like hops. So it produces a lot of these terpenes that are produced in these other plants. And many of these terpenes, just like the cannabinoids, are bioactive. So they do things in our body. So they don't just smell good. So that's what's potentiating the effects of THC or the other cannabinoids you're ingesting. So, and that's why one strain from the next has a slightly different effect. But you know, and then just to kind of give you an idea of the constituents of cannabis, a really good cannabis flower is going to test somewhere around from 20 to 30% in THC content by dry weight. You take a cannabis flower, you dry it out, 30% of the weight of that flower to 20 to 30%. 30% is on the very high end. That's a very high concentration. But just to demonstrate kind of the amount of resin that the cannabis plant produces is significant. And then somewhere between 0.5% to 1.5%, sometimes we see strains that go even higher on that, of the dried cannabis flower is going to be terpenes, other than the cannabinoids. So all the other aromatic terpenes that are going to give it its smell, its flavor. And that's in the dry plant. But like Alex said, if you cut down a fresh plant, you're going to have a lot, you know, significantly more, more terpenes as concentration of the overall plant.
So this is always my problem on the show, is because I start talking about one part of the topic that we're talking about, and I could talk about it all day, but I have my whole list of questions here and other things that I really want to get to. So. Hey, that's a great introduction on terpenes, and it very, very informative, and I appreciate that. But this is a question that I also get from a lot of people as well, and especially my clients right now who are going to be opening up craft grows if they get their licenses. And who decides what Blue Dream is? Who gets to decide? And this kind of ties in. I know you guys have talked about national standards, both from the safety end, all of that, but also specifically kind of from this idea of having uniformity, so that if we have somebody says I'm selling Blue Dream and I really like it and I'm in California and then I wind up in Illinois and I want to go in and buy Blue Dream, how do I have any idea that it's the same? How does that work in this industry?
Well, scientifically, we have multiple ways that we can sort of define a strain and you know, certainly there's plenty of qualitative ways, and certainly it's been an issue in the past with kind of sort of strain standards like you're talking about. But you know, scientifically, I can define a strain as a chemotype, which is sort of the sum of the chemical constituents of the plant. So for a Blue Dream, we can set standards for the cannabinoid content. You know, how much THC does it have? How much CBD does it have? How much CBG does it have? And then what are the terpenes and what are the ratios to one another? So, you know, is it a myrcene dominant, you know, with pinene as the secondary terpene? That's a Blue Dream. And then beyond that, if a breeder is looking to develop a new strain or chemotype or chemovar or what, there's multiple ways to sort of words you can use to define a strain even, then they can develop that strain. And then have it genetically fingerprinted, and there's multiple ways you can do that. But they can, you know, not now it's the those types of technologies have come down in cost to the point where they're within reach of cannabis breeders. And shoot, nowadays cannabis breeders are as well funded as anyone else. But even you know, kind of the old school garage breeders can afford to, you know, you can sort of fingerprint a strain for a few hundred bucks, and then you have a definitive answer on what constitutes that strain. Well, it's the genetics. So I think from a scientific point of view, those are the two best ways. Now there's certainly a lot of qualitative ways.
And to add to that, I agree, you know, cause I think the answer is like twofold. I think it's the chemotype fingerprinting, right? Is it high THC? Is it a type one? Is high THC, low CBD. Blue Dream is a type one, high THC, low CBD strain with myrcene and pinene, right? That which make a mass, you know, the vast majority of the profile, and most of it's myrcene, like maybe half or less of the amount of myrcene is pinene, and so I think for one, it's identifying that you have the verified genetics, and then two, it's about having educated bud tenders that are able to help people to find the right strain, especially if they can't smell it, you know, because exactly right. like you're saying is the Blue Dream you're getting, you know, on, you know, because I think it's a self-responsibility thing of knowing the smell of the strain, like training your olfactory right. system to like know that, right. okay, myrcene is that fruity kind of smell, right? So that is, so once you kind of can further, and a bud tender further can identify, okay, there's all these fruit strains, you know, Tangy, Forbidden Fruit, Mango, Blue Dream. What differentiates Blue Dream among those strains is the little bit of pining it has. And so, you know, being able to, for one, you know that, you know, just train your nose on these 5-6 primary terpenes, and to be able to help kind of guide people to that, you know, because, you know, it's, you know, where, you know, there's so much suggestive selling and you know, that happens of pushing strains that are called certain names. And then there's also a lot of placebo effect pushing that's happening there, because a lot of people are getting Blue Dream thinking it's this myrcene strain, but then they're getting like a terpenylene dominant, like haze strain, that, you know, because somebody thinks that Blue Dream is a sativa. So they're giving them this strain that they think is a Blue Dream or is on the sativa end, but that's like a totally different terpene. And that could have a very negative effect on somebody, or it could influence the placebo effect, but it's just so complex. And I just think right. there has to be a lot more accountability in the leadership of the community to take terpenes seriously and to, like, you know, to do the plant justice on the level that the plant's here for us to give it justice. And it's to, like, you know, be intelligent in how we speak about it, and to push the boundaries of the ignorance of how, and the misinformation that we just ignorantly perpetuate.
Okay. And one more quick question I'm going to slip in here along those lines is this. Testing obviously becomes more and more important and really crucial once you're a license holder, because most states require testing of one kind or another. In that context, it's oftentimes to make sure that the product is safe and free of harmful pesticides or things like that. But also, I would imagine that a lot of that is also for truth in advertising. So if you want to advertise a particular strain and what its THC content might be, you have something to get an accurate measure. Now, here's the question, because I know everyone in the industry talks about national standards and even statewide standards. What happens if my partner and I, you know, at a cultivation center, we each take our sample of the same strain. I go to one lab, he goes to another lab, and we come back with different reports. In other words, is that possible? How do we ensure uniformity so that, you know, if I get a result from a lab, I can feel confident that this is a good result?
I'll answer that, but it's accountability on the labs, and it's the state creating a system of robust auditing and ongoing auditing of the labs, that are, because the labs are the final integrity check and the integrity of the supply chain.
Yeah, I mean, I would second what Alex said. Cannabis is actually a really difficult plant to test for a number of reasons, and for most of the tests we do, most plants aren't, you know, sort of dried, resinous plants that need to be tested, you know, to very low levels for some of the contaminants we're looking for in California and Oregon and elsewhere. So it is a tough nut to crack. But at the same time, I think early on, labs like ours, there was no regulation because there's no requirements for testing. So, you know, we get, you know, sort of that any of the international accreditations like ISO accreditation as a laboratory. Some labs did, you know, a lot didn't. And so there was really no requirement for the rigor of the labs. And so you got kind of what you would expect under that type of situation. And, you know, as we went into regulations, there was, you know, there's kind of a lot of, you know, a lot of leeway left to the labs to sort of come up to a certain standard to do this testing. And I think we're getting there. I think you know, these days that concern, it should happen a lot less if you're using, you know, reputable labs. But you know, like Alex said, I think it's on the job of regulators in these states to really hold the laboratories to a high standard. Certainly there's a lot of incentive for labs like ours to jack up THC scores for our customers or, you know, pass them on a pesticide test that they shouldn't pass on, because there's a lot of money involved in these batches, and we're sort of the gatekeepers on quality and regulatory end. So if the state isn't, you know, providing a lot of oversight to labs like ours, you know, there's just a lot of incentive for shenanigans. And so we've seen that get a lot better over the years, and as the industry matures, the laboratories are maturing as well. And so hopefully that's getting better. And it's just, you know, it's on the laboratory industry to hold itself to a high standard, and it's certainly on the regulators to kind of enforce that. And then, for what it's worth, when we're talking terpenes, since that's, you know, been a big theme of what we've been talking about here, the terpene assay is one of the hardest assays for labs to get right, and there's still a lot of laboratories that are misidentifying terpenes, because, you know, it's really complex plant, and the terpenes are there usually in very trace amounts. So that's I could go on all day about
standards. Let me ask you this question, guys. Who is your customer base? Do you work primarily with cultivation centers? Do you work with individual growers? Do you work with somebody who just wants to walk in off the street and say, hey, can you tell me what this bud is?
Back in the day before comprehensive regulations in California and Oregon took place, you know, largely we tested for dispensaries that would be receiving product and then test it and want to, you know, advertise the THC and terpene content and test it for pesticides so they can charge a premium. Now, essentially, there's all this in process testing that takes place, you know, from the time of cultivation to the time of extraction to the time of product formulation or infusion, you know, getting products ready for final form and in packaged cartridges, you know, and then so so each licensee will do their own amount of as little or as much R&D testing as they feel like they need to do to ensure, to hedge their bet, to ensure that they're not going to put 10,000 cartridges fully packaged, ready to go to market at a distributor's location, where then a final compliance test will take place, where the laboratory comes through, takes a representative sampling of the batch, goes back, the state's involved, metrics involved, you know, there's no turning back at that point. And then, you know, if it passes all these quality marks, then it gets a green light. If it fails any of the marks, the state's involved, the Department of Public Health is involved, and the product has to be remediated or destroyed. So it's this very severe and consequential event. And so, yeah, so there's, so each licensee will kind of do their due diligence in that way.
Okay. Fantastic. And how do people get in touch with you?
STlabs.com. We're on Instagram _STlabs, Twitter STlaboratories, also on Facebook. We try to kind of keep it relevant and put out information that's helping to educate, you know, kind of consumers and all those that are, you know, in service to cannabis, to understand, and, you know, the science of cannabis and how to, you know, engage with it to learn how to, you know, optimize whatever it is you're doing in life.
And we're talking with Josh Werzer and Alec Dixon. Jim, welcome to the show. And what's going on with you?
I just landed at Logan Airport and drove out here to Worcester, where I'm consulting on a large cannabis cultivation.
Very nice. Very nice. Well, Josh and Alec have been kind enough to kind of walk us through the world of terpenes and testing and trying to set up some consistency standards across the country, you know, to really bring some accountability to the industry. What experience, Jim, do you have in terms of working with people with testing labs?
We have several labs as clients for Bridge West as a CPA firm. I'm not a scientist by any means, but I know that, and maybe these gentlemen can chime in, Alex and Josh, I know that heavy metals are a bit of a concern. Tell us about that, and, you know, how do heavy metals get into cannabis plants? I guess that's my first question.
I would love to answer that. One of my biggest roles within STlabs, going back since 2018, or actually 2019, when heavy metal testing kicked in, is, you know, to help people identify and do root cause kind of analysis to trace back and figure out where and how heavy metals fails come about. And so I've learned quite a bit about the topic. And so And I've actually learned quite a bit of about the topic from one of Josh and my dear friends, Roy Upton, who's the executive director of the American Herbal Pharmacopeia. And so cannabis and hemp equally, you know, they're this great phytoremediator of toxins from the soil. And so they accumulate toxins. And so heavy metals, most of the heavy metal accumulation that occurs within cannabis happens within the roots and the shoots of the plant, not necessarily in the fruits and the flower. So why do heavy metal fails on flower happen? Right. And so what we see kind of across our data since 2019 is, you know, there's about 2 to 3% fail rate across all heavy metal testing we perform on flowers, extracts, infused products with cacao in them and stuff like that. We see lead almost exclusively is an issue with manufacturing and kind of what the cannabis and terpenes are being stored in, leaching that takes place from Chinese manufactured hardware, kind of from shitty Chinese glass that kind of leaches metals. You know, there's a lot of sources where metals, you know, styrofoam, it, you know, styrofoam has incredible amounts of heavy metal in it. So if it's sitting on tincture vials that are coming to the United States sitting on styrofoam, each one of those vials has lead on it. So that's one thing. And then so as far as flower, where fails in flower come from everything we've seen, there's about 2% fail rate that happen. 1% is for arsenic, 1% separately is for cadmium. And in pretty much every instance where we've, you know, so fail rates are really low on flower, right? So, even though heavy metals, you can test in any sample of soil, you know, but again, most of the roots and the shoots are accumulating the metals. But the failing flower happens from whatever's being foliar applied to the plant, right? So foliar application of metals can either happen directly or indirectly. Like indirectly would be, say, you're outside in a really high wind corridor area. You're growing full sun outdoor and, you know, metals get gusted up from the soil and just dust your sticky plants. You just foliar applied indirectly metals right onto your sticky plants. So fails can happen that way. And then they can also happen through what you're spraying on the plants. So, integrated pest management, you know, pesticide sprays, you know, all these inputs that people are, you know, might spray every week on the foliage of their plants. You know, it's wise to do due diligence on those products and ensure that they're low in heavy metal content. You know, because I mean, you can test fish, you could test seaweed, you could test, you know, all these different inputs, and they could have 30, 40 part per million of cadmium or mercury on them, or arsenic. And so it's, you know, if you have, you know, inputs that have metals on them, don't put them on the foliage of the plants and spray them. Give them to the roots and allow the roots and the shoots to accumulate it.
These answers that you guys have been given today, guys, are great. And I'm sure Jim and I, could come up with 100 more questions for you. But before we run out of time, we always like to check in on the musical side of things for the Grateful Dead, Fish, the jam band scene, and really any music that's out there. Jim, what's your latest on the music scene?
You know, I've really been enjoying the Fish channel. I've been in the car quite a bit, and I've been listening to a lot of Fish. And what's interesting is, you know, is we older deadheads bat around what was, you know, Jerry's best year, what was the Grateful Dead's best tour, and a lot of people come up with 1977. Something very similar for Fish, that 1998 seems to be a peak year for Fish, which is very interesting because both bands had been around for about the same amount of time, the Dead in 77 and Fish in 98. There's a school of thought that says you need 10,000 hours to master your craft. And so maybe both bands hit their 10,000 hours. But I've really been enjoying listening to Fish in the car.
Yeah, that's been great. Did you have a chance to listen to Dave's Picks 35, the Philadelphia show?
Yes, I've listened to it start to finish a couple of times and enjoying it very much. I touched on the Touch of Grey, and then the third disc has the bonus track of Terrapin Station, very solid Terrapin Station from 77.
Yeah, no, it's a great show. I was at that show in Philly in 1984 at the Philly Civic Center. You know, and as we talked about last time, I think it's just always great when they finally release a show that you were at. You know, and you have a chance to pre-listen to it and say, oh, yeah, I do remember all of that. It was great. switching back to our guests for a minute, I understand that at SC Labs, you guys have a small world Grateful Dead story for us, and one of your employees was connected to who in the band?
So we were blessed to be friends with and to know Bill Kreutzmann's daughter, Bella, stepdaughter. Bella was a great laboratory technician and scientist that worked with us at SC Labs for a couple years. She has since kind of moved back to live with her family in Hawaii. But yeah, very kind of synchronistic, random little add in there.
Very cool. And I like that story because, you know, I think that in the Grateful Dead history and whatever, you know, outside of their nightly drum solos, the drummers, you know, tend to get a little more short shrift than Jerry and Bobby and the boys who are up front. But there's a whole school of thought that I'm at least a partial adherent to, if not making my way over there full time, that Billy was really the heart and soul of the band. And he really kept things moving from back there. Mickey took his time off for a while, and Billy supposedly had the closest relationship to Jerry out of any of them. And he's one guy in the band who I would really like to, you know, get a chance to sit down and just chat with, because he seems to be fascinating. Did she have good stories to share with you?
I work up front. She was more in the laboratory, kind of in her zone in the science. So I, you know, but aside just kind of hanging out, you know, here and there, you know, I never really got, you know, the opportunity to be able to get any of the stories.
Well, it's always, you know, look, that's, like I say, in this world, that's one of the cool things about the Dead is you never have to swing a baseball bat very far to hit somebody who's got some connection, some story, you know, some two or three or fourth degree of a separation. And Jim and I have talked about those stories a number of times, clients and business people. And in fact, just a few weeks ago, we had on the show one of the attorneys who I work with, Bob Hoban, the head of the Hoban Law Group. And, you know, Bob likes to play a game where when he gives his professional presentations, he tries to mix in as many Grateful Dead lyrics as he can along the way. And it just it makes it great fun for us. In your work, though, I know you were talking a little bit earlier about, you know, celebrities and stuff like that. Do you have, you know, musicians who would drop in on you from time to time to get your thoughts on what was available in the marijuana market?
Yeah, I mean, in you know, even just living in Santa Cruz, you can't help but kind of overlap with a, you know, Grateful Dead history. I used to live in a place just outside of Santa Cruz that called Lompico, and you know, we were right down the road from, I guess, Jerry Garcia's aunt's house, where apparently he was chopping wood as a young child, whole story. And there was a house owned by Janis Joplin out in the woods that you kind of had to hike to that we'd throw parties. So, I mean, there's just all of that's kind of, you know, this is sort of, you know, San Francisco's playground, still is. And so you run into that all the time. And shoot, I mean, the Soundtrap guys are from Santa Cruz, so I know you guys are Grateful Dead and Fish guys, but you know, can't help but cross paths with those guys. I was
in Zach.
Yeah, they're at our Christmas party last year. So but yeah, and so I guess cool. There you go. That's a crossing path. And we two of the members of the Wu-Tang Clan shot a music video in our laboratory. That was pretty fun. And then afterwards we had a pizza party and birthday cake. It was our sales guy's birthday, and Killer Priest and Ghostface Killer saying happy birthday to our sales guy. And that was a little bit surreal. So yeah, it has been fun as well working in this industry, because you definitely, you know, not only do you get to cross paths with you know, some of the kind of the luminaries and kind of the forward thinkers of the cannabis industry, but there's a lot of overlap between, you know, kind of the artist community as well. And so, you know, and I think both me and Alec have done a lot of that, and certainly have spent a lot of time kind of in the whole kind of festival scene through the years, which, you know, kind of started for me with the jam bands, and then kind of went a lot to kind of more of the, you know, electronic music as well. You know, kind of big into kind of music producers, and I think it's kind of cool how sort of the composers have had their moment here a little bit. I know people are kind of polarized on the whole electronic scene, but for me, I think it's really cool that, you know, that it celebrates sort of the composer.
And I'm sorry, real quick, I just wanted to add in, I apologize. I just wanted to add in just, you know, paying respect and giving thanks how much the plants, cannabis, plant medicines, the psychedelic kind of influence of culture, and how much, you know, the sound of music has been able to really kind of help progress both in certain ways across time.
Very good point, Alec. And yes, I've seen Sound Tribe Sector 9 several times at Red Rocks on a multi-band evening, three or four bands. And they kind of have both a foot in both camps, electronic music as well as the jam band scene. So they're a little bit of both.
Yep, I like them too. They're a lot of fun. And, you know, you guys keep talking about Santa Cruz, and, you know, my greatest regret in my life is that I didn't discover UC Santa Cruz until the second semester of my senior year of college, when I went out there to visit somebody. And I thought, why didn't anybody tell me about this place when I was applying to college? But it was beautiful. I love Santa Cruz. Went for a ride on the roller coaster down on the pier, and it was quite an experience.
I was actually a junior transfer into UCSC. I went to Cabrillo College here in Santa Cruz for 2 years, and I did a junior transfer to UCSC. And then that fall in you know, around October, I ended up not continuing because we opened up SC Labs, and that was back in October of 2009.
Yeah, so you've been, your lab has kind of been right where it needed to be starting in 2009, 2010. That was when I started signing cannabis tax returns. It was the same year. That's when Colorado really got going.
Yeah, and initially, I mean, for those of you who kind of understand geography of California, I don't want to get too geography heavy here, but you know, Santa Cruz is sort of over a mountain range from the Bay Area, and so, you know, there probably was a business case nowadays to be more in the heart of the Bay Area where the population center is, but early on, Santa Cruz was very cannabis friendly. So there was, you know, sort of the Emerald Triangle. There's, you know, Mendocino and Humboldt and Trinity. But then Santa Cruz County was also very friendly and had very liberal cannabis laws. And I mean, nationwide, the cannabis movement got its start in a lot of ways in Santa Cruz with WAM. And certainly we've been really involved with WAM from the beginning. And all that happened here that led to the referendum in 1996. For Prop 215, and so we've definitely, you know, kind of we chose to stay here, not just because we lived here and opened the lab here, but also just because you know, back then we didn't know if, you know, the laboratories were still highly illegal, and we didn't know if we were going to get, you know, arrested on day one from opening the lab, you know, as you know, sort of as a drug processor or something like that. So we chose Santa Cruz sort of for the safety it provided as well.
We covered this, but as we wrap it up today, why don't you give people one more chance to be able to contact you if they want to do business with you on testing, if they're in your area or not. Go ahead and tell us about your website and how to contact you.
Yeah, so we test kind of cannabis and hemp in California and Oregon. We test hemp nationally. You can contact us anytime at info@sclabs.com, sclabs.com. You can also find us on social media, like Instagram _SC Labs, Twitter, I believe is SC Labs or SC Laboratories, and also same on Facebook. But yeah, really grateful to be here, and thank you for having us.
Well, thank you very much. And that just leads me to one more question. You take samples from all over the country?
For hemp. We do hemp testing across the nation.
My next question was, how did they get it to you?
So hemp through the mail. We receive hemp samples kind of through the mail, kind of as long as, you know, point below 0.3% THC. You know, we work with, you know, several manufacturers and kind of hemp flower producers kind of in various regions. Also, we have been appointed one of the, I want to say, two or three labs that is able to perform hemp testing in the state of Texas. So we're sanctioned and commissioned kind of, you know, in the states of California, Oregon, and Texas, you know, to do testing for hemp kind of as part of the state process. But we also do receive samples testing for hemp, people doing different kind of processing or sourcing or infused product making, stuff like that.
Yeah, but please don't just send us samples. We'll give us a call and we'll set it up. And definitely don't mail us any cannabis from outside the state.
Thank you.
It's a nice thought, but please don't.
All right. Well, very good, gentlemen. So this is Jim Marty saying over and out from Central Massachusetts, where I'm on a cannabis business trip.
Jim, always a pleasure. I hope your trip goes successfully out there. And to everyone else, thank you again for listening. Thanks to Josh and Alec. Everyone have a good week. Stay safe, stay healthy. We'll talk to you next week. Thank you.